Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
And welcome. Welcome to an hour of Mind Power Plus Leadership Power. Yes, we're going to be talking about what you can do to be, number one, a more effective communicator, but also, number two, walk your talk. Be able to really understand what leadership is really about. My guest, Terry Pierce, has put together a publication that, believe me, is something that you can't speed read through. You're going to want to really think about many of the paradigms of change in the way of perception that may be introduced into your own thinking. His book is called Leading Out Loud. It's a guide for engaging others in creating the future. If you're feeling somewhat helpless at this time, when you listen to the media, when you are in conversation with other people and you look around and you go, there's got to be something we can change. Communication isn't what it should be. We are in such a cycle of intensity when it comes to the technology of the day and so much more. What can you do? Well, I like to think that Terry's material can perhaps create this shift within thinking that always begins the shifts of change. It's always with a thought. And maybe we can plant a seed that is going to be able to empower you as a person to make a difference, not just in your life, but in affecting the lives of others. Terry Pierce, welcome to the show.
Profound. I was making notes myself.
Oh, Terry, thanks so much. It reminds me of this story that you had in your book where a guy is giving a talk and he's putting out information and somebody's scribbling down notes and that person has to leave the room to go answer a phone call or something, and he peeks over at the notes and the guy's writing down the rebuttal.
Yes, exactly.
Terry.
That's kind of the story of most communication, isn't it?
Oh, so often. I mean, we automatically do it as people. Whenever, especially if we are engaged in a meeting, whether it's with a corporation or it is a political environment or it is a conference with a family, it's like, I just want you to know, and it's in the head, I'm going to be able to put together opposition. I've done it, and I've got a member in my family. That's exactly what they do. They are ready. It's like, woohoo, I have a chance here. I'm going to figure out what's not working with what you say, even before they hear it.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. It is a point of view that we have.
It's fascinating.
To your point, I was listening to the introduction. I'm interested in etymologies and, you know, how words are formed. And there's an archaic meaning of communication that I just ran into, actually, in the Oxford English Dictionary, and it really was enlightening to me because it suggested that communication is not about what's said, but about who's present, about, you know, people being present, and specifically spirit being present. And
mm-hmm.
So little communication today has that spiritual aspect to it, where the spirit is not there. It's really just words against a topic.
That's a very, very true statement. And that's one of the points, one of the many points. Your book is, again, something that when you read it, you really want to think about what's being said. And you incorporate a lot of wisdom from the past. And I really love history because I think you have to understand history to know why we have gotten, let's say, to where we are, or why we haven't gotten where we should be. We need to understand that, and it's a very difficult process in today's world because we have this instantaneous, well, how come it's not fixed attitude.
Right.
And it reminds me, right now, for example, I have a situation with an automobile. I'm going to digress with a story here for just a moment. And this is real. This is now. I have having a problem. Something's draining my battery. So that is related to the electrical system in the car. Well, they do a diagnostic. They say, well, there's this little bit of something here. It's draining, but it's not enough. It shouldn't drain a brand new battery. And so they're having to go back, and they're having to check something out because there can be a little bit of drain somewhere. And maybe it's a loose wire. Maybe it's something broken. Now, I use that as an analogy because when it comes to communication, you're not always going to have an instant fix. Sometimes you have to go through a system to find out where a break is, where there is a weak point, to understand why a whole system doesn't work and
yes,
why it
right.
is literally draining away. And, you know, I look at companies. Things like this can happen with companies. And that's why I wanted to share that story with you. Your book, Leading Out Loud, to me is very significant. Because you, right now, today, we are experiencing, not just in the United States, but around the world, the insufficiency of effective leadership. And I'm not talking about somebody up there with cymbals going, ding, 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 pay attention to me, I look good today, I'm the big kahuna on the moment. No, that's not what I'm talking about. Real leadership. Thinkers. And we?
Yes. Yeah,
where are they?
Well, it's there. Unfortunately, there are some around, but we don't know much about them because they don't make the news nearly as much as we'd like them to. And there have been some historically that we know of. And, of course, there are some that are still alive. I mean, Mandela is certainly one of those who not only thought but felt his way into a position of leadership and was able to relate to such a great big constituency. Speaking of your battery analogy, I mean, Mandela was one that really had a grasp of how to create a shared context, so he could actually go back in history and paint a picture of where we'd been and where we are as the basis for where we're going. And when everybody has that same understanding, it's fairly obvious where the leak of energy is, and you can step up and fix it.
Mm-hmm. Right, but you have to make the effort to find out where that leak is. Now, I want my audience to know that Business Week magazine said you were the eminence grise of executive coaches. You are the founder and president of Leadership Communication. You have worked with people in all kinds of business environments and even public officials. And you've taught at the University of California, Berkeley, the Haas School of Business, and the London Business School. And obviously, you do a lot of speaking. You're a man that really has a passion for education. And I am one that really believes that education is a lifelong experience. And I'm a testament myself to that. You never stop learning. You never stop growing. And I think when you do, you're in trouble. You, when writing this book. This obviously took you a long time, Terry.
Mm-hmm.
When did you decide that you were going to really sit down and communicate the messages that you have in this book?
Well, of course, it's been a life's work for me, Donna. I started, the first edition of this book came out in 1995, and it really was about speaking. It was about, you know, they say you always write your first book for the publisher, and the publisher wanted a book on basically presentations and public speaking. So that's what the first book was about. But as I began to research it and experience it, I knew that my primary message in my life was going to be that the message comes from within and that I needed to start there. So the second edition is much broader in terms of its scope and the number of communication episodes or situations that it covers. It also is very heavily into discovering who you are and what matters before you start to open your mouth or put pen to paper. The third one, which is the edition that we're talking about now, which just came out in March of this last year, really broadens that to not only include the various means that we use for communication, goodness knows there are plenty of them, but also the fact that we live in a global environment now. And I was very interested in how messages can be transmitted cross-culturally without regard to where people come from economically or spiritually or geographically. So I took myself back to school when I was 60 years old and did a degree in comparative mythology, to your point, just so that I could get a real strong feeling for what the universal stories were and how leadership communication can inspire across those lines.
And that's very, very important. You have a fascinating story about Japan, and this is in a section of your book where it involves dealing with cultures, and I would like to address that, because sure. You speak of how in Japan, because of technology, there has been a tremendous gap between the younger generation and the older generation. Actually, you started out with a story about a bank.
Yes.
And I'd like you to tell that story, and then tell the story about how there's a young man that you speak of, and how he said that there were a lot of things that the younger generation couldn't understand because they weren't in communication with the older generation. Address those two issues.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, of course, in Japanese, there's a certain privacy that is recognized because it's a very dense country. As you know, the population is very dense. And so people are constantly jockeying for personal space, both physically as well as psychically. And so the old stories aren't carried forward as much as they used to be. So there were reasons in this particular case, there were reasons why the bank had certain policies toward their borrowers that the younger generation just didn't understand because they'd never heard the stories. And that created all kinds of confusion. You know, it meant that the new generation was just going through the motions. They didn't have the feeling for it, and they didn't have the wherewithal to establish the relationships with those older clients. And it created a lot of consternation. A lot of Japanese young people, particularly the good ones, started going away to school and relocating in other parts of the world because they were becoming westernized. The story was actually related to me by a student of mine at the London Business School, and he put it exactly that way. He said, I got to the point where I didn't feel like I understood my own culture, and I needed to get out and see it against a backdrop, which then allowed me to understand why the bank did business the way it did and to go back and actually be much more effective in the system.
And when this happened with him, then he had a deeper understanding, too, of how to work with the older generation.
Yes,
and
he did.
The bank also changed the way they dealt with the consumer, their customers, because they had to educate their customers. The bank went through a cycle where people were saying, you're making lousy decisions. We want to know why our money isn't there. My goodness.
Correct.
And we relate to that in the United States. You bet.
Yeah, we understand.
By golly, they didn't have to. They could have ignored it, but they would have found themselves in a furor that was just incredible. So they started educating their customers. They started having classes.
Yes. And, of course, that's what really, really good financial services companies do now. But the world of finance has become so complex that it's been a challenge for people to be able to translate the story of how investments are made today into nomenclature that the average person can understand it. The bank did a really good job of going back and not only explaining it, but finding out ways to communicate through story and through example that would help their own clients know what they were doing.
Very important. I want to quote from your book. I really like this because I have said this so many times. And this is your quote. Many leaders in all fields, particularly politics, are too quick to patronize their public, assuming they are either selfish, dull, or uninterested in global or universal questions. Quite the contrary. The public is eager to hear, eager to engage, and eager to act when called to contribute to just causes that are larger than themselves, even when they don't understand the details.
Mm-hmm.
And I detest this dumbing down. I see it done in media so much, and it is appalling. It is absolutely appalling. And a good leader does not do this.
No, a good leader has great respect for constituents, and that's you know, the primary point. In fact, I think I used the example in there of Stephen Hawking, who wrote a very, very complex book at one point called a brief History of Time. Now, this book came out, and he actually wrote it under a grant. Of course, Hawking is one of the world's most preeminent physicists, astrophysicists. And it was said at the time that if you could read this book and understand a little bit of it, that you'd be well on your way to a PhD in astrophysics. And he actually wrote it because he thought it would make a little money to help him send his daughter to school. But it sold over 5 million copies in more than 17 languages. And people were just carrying it around with them under their arm. And when asked, you know, why he thought the book had sold so well, and it, by the way, it continues to, that whole body of work, he said, I think it's because people are really interested in the really big questions, questions of meaning, questions of origin. And when you give them something that helps them in that regard, they will not only buy it, they'll read it and they'll carry it around because they want to be engaged that way.
Mm-hmm.
We all stare at the night sky and wonder, you know, from time to time, that there's a miracle. It's a miracle that there's anything here at all. So anyone that can feed that deep desire to know and to understand our environment is going to be quite successful as a leader.
You say a leader is not a change agent. So many times people like to describe people that way. But you say a real leader is a creator of progress. What brought you to that positioning? Because most people think that the noisiest person, the loudest person, the rah-rah-rah person that's up there that's in the best-looking clothes, drives the fancy car, and is just out there, boy, that's the leader. That's not a leader.
No.
That is a PR special.
That's
not
that's
a leader.
Right.
Let's get into what you feel really makes a leader.
Sure. In fact, I define it very, I always have, I've defined it since 1995, that leadership is about inspiration, is to inspire people to willingly take action to affect change. And the emphasis there is on inspire and willingly. So it doesn't have to do with holding somebody's paycheck or having leverage over them politically. It has to do with inspiring the best in them so that they'll actually move forward willingly and move toward a future that is not just change. And with regard to that, I came to that conclusion about change and progress just by reading some psychological studies that show beyond a shadow of a doubt that people hate change. They really don't like it because it can seem to be willy-nilly. It can be disruptive. It moves people from a place of comfort to a place of discomfort. But those same studies indicate that people love progress. So they hate change, but they love progress. And progress is just change with a purpose. So if the leader is able to communicate where we are going, where the future is brighter by means of what he or she wants to change, then it becomes progress, and then it's desirable. But that's the nature of leadership communication. It's inspirational, and it's about progress, not change.
You went through a particular experience many years ago, and it was with IBM. In San Francisco, and you make a statement in your book, leaders simply must know their own values if they are to inspire others. Now, I preface this with that statement because when you were with IBM, you were 26 years old, and you were in a group with a gentleman by the name of David.
Yes.
And he asked a question, three words in the question. Who are you?
Right, exactly.
And say what happened and what humbled you because of that question asked.
Yeah, right. Well, Dave was a very, very spiritual guy, a big, almost physically imposing human being. He was my first boss at IBM, and I was, you know, I was a hotshot kid out of Oregon that was I was a good salesman, and I'd done quite well for the small amount of time that I'd been with the company. But this was in a sales meeting. And of course, in those days, all the salespeople were male, and we were sitting around a table, and Dave just came in that day and said, look, I just want you to focus on this question and write down the answer, and then we're going to go around, and everybody's going to give feedback on what they thought. And he said, the question is, who are you? And, everybody shuffled around a little bit and bent their heads, and I guess I was the youngest in the room, but there were several people that were around my age, and then there were some older people in their mid-30s and a little bit older. So we started going around the room. Fortunately, I was quite a ways from the start of the process, and everyone started to relate who they were, and they would do so in terms of the roles that they played in life and what they wanted to do and what they liked to do. So somebody would say, "Well, I am a husband," or I am a golfer, or I am an avid skier, or I am a thoughtful Christian, even, or something like that. And so it was about their activities and kind of what they did in life. I'm a husband, I'm a father, and so forth. And I got the hang of it. And I thought, okay, because I was a little mystified as a 26-year-old this question, and I was a little bit afraid. But as it started to come around the room, it was pretty clear that people were defining it that way, and I got comfortable and made a short list and thought, I'll get out of this pretty easily. Unfortunately for me, but fortunately for me, later on, the guy to my right was a Vietnam vet who had been in battle. He'd been in the Navy. He was a little older. He was about 35 at the time. His name was Ed McDonald. I'll never forget him, because when it came around to Ed, Ed had made a very short list, and he just looked up from his paper at the group and said in his very clear voice, he said, "I am a free man," and then paused, and the whole room was quiet, and I was absolutely petrified. Because I realized at that moment that Ed had taken the question the way Dave had meant it. Who are you at heart? You know, what's your essence, is what Dave was asking us. Not what we did. Everybody did the same thing. But it made me grow up in that instant and start to ask that question of myself in a much deeper way.
I don't know that many of us in our 20s would even begin to know how to think that way, because so often through the educational system and through social environments, wherever we might find ourselves, there's an indoctrination process. And for you to have been given this gift of that experience, that enabled you to start your journey of independent thinking. And that is something that, in my observation, needs to be cultivated. This is this is not something that's encouraged. It's not exclusive to being in the United States. It's not exclusive to any country. It's a natural process, and we all want to fit in. Yeah. We all want to be comfortable. We all want to make it okay that we're like everybody else. That is something that is so indicative of the human being's tribal spirit, tribal soul. It's there.
Yeah.
And when you don't fit that, you go out and try on a lot of costumes. That's how I like to try.
That's right. That's a good way of putting it. Just put on your jewelry every morning and go out and do it. And you know, it's an interesting thing, because you're right, the school system certainly doesn't, at least the one that we know, doesn't foster this kind of thinking, and certainly there is not a lot of introspection. There's so much noise going on in the universe now that it's rare that anyone goes out and actually sits underneath the stars at night and looks up and says, "Holy cow, you know, what's this all about?" When I was about 15 years ago now, I actually enrolled in a school that was a replica of a 13th century Persian mystery school.
Ooh.
For 2 weeks over a period of a year, I got to experience the mystical tradition of every major religion. And there was a teacher in the group. We had nine days in a retreat, and then we had 6 months off, and then we had 9 more days in retreat. And in that 6 months, we got to choose a teacher among that group that we would relate to. And it was all aimed at exactly what you're talking about, at getting at the mystery of who we are and thinking more deeply about the essence of who we are and what we're here to do. That, I think, is an essential element of leadership. If someone hasn't spent the time to be introspective about who they are and what their values are, they simply have no place to come from. There's nothing that they can, you know, there's nothing they can do. I mean, they could want to build a dam, which would make them a great engineer, but if they don't know the essence of why they want to build a dam, what that water could do, what the implications would be, who would be helped, who would be hurt, if they haven't thought that through their essence about what they want to contribute, then they're not going to be able to lead and inspire the way that I define it.
Mm-hmm. And I think there is this, I'll call it a hunger, that is happening at this time, which I think is healthy. I really think it's healthy. Because in the minds and hearts of people, those that are older are saying, where are the leaders? Those that are younger are saying, I want someone that can be a real good example for me. I don't see anybody.
Yeah.
And then those that are in between say, well, we've got to take care of making sure the ship runs. Mm-hmm. So we'll put it out on the water and we'll take care of everyday business. And maybe if we're lucky, we'll see something along the way. Or we'll find somebody that can manage the rudder or fix the engines, what have you. I find this a phenomena that, again, is indicative in human history prior to dramatic changes in the spirit of the individuals that then say, we must progress. We are going to progress. It's not we're going to sit and analyze it until it becomes powder. We are going to take the action now. We have to stand up. We have to speak out. And one of the things that you say, which I think relates to that very condition, which is evolving now. You look at what's happened in Egypt. You look at different parts of the world, different cultures, different environments here in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
There is that it is time now. The gig is up. But there is a process that has to evolve before that progress can be made. And usually it's pretty painful.
Yes.
It's not fun because it's, as you said right at the beginning when we started talking, it's unsettling. But you say, until you know who you are and your essence, you can't really lead.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
And I thought, my goodness, that is so true. That is so true. And yet, we are, I think people are really disgusted at not having that essence of integrity, sincerity, practicality, and reality being expressed. Now, there's a few tiny voices that are beginning to come up, but you're hearing all of the bandwagons of the old school. And this is all across everything, business, politics, education, you name it, it's happening out there.
Yes, I think so. And in fact, it's intensifying because you can tell when you begin to argue about the details, then you know that you're off course, that you've lost the inspiration. And that's all we do these days politically, is just argue about the details. Just take a polarized approach and argue it until we're blue in the face and no one's listening. No one's looking for a way to mold those things together and create a future that we would all be happy with.
You talk about processes for someone. Your book is, in a way, a how-to book, but in another way, it is really trying, you are really trying to communicate with the reader. You're wanting the reader to understand that they, in their own positioning, whether they're a mechanic working at an auto shop, a minister of a church, a person that's involved in politics, an individual who is teaching, they have a voice. But they need to learn how to communicate with that voice, to know their real essence. And that's why I think your book is one. It's not all that thick a book, but it's one that creates a lot of thinking. And not unlike the retreat you went to, this is a chance for someone to be able to integrate within themselves and to really ask some pretty powerful questions.
Well, thank you. That was the essence of the book. It really is two books, as you said. It's the first half of the book really has to do with the instrument, with the leader himself or herself, and how I think one has to develop in order to form a point of view that will allow you to inspire. So that's the first part of the book, and there are some things that I suggest that are necessary for that to happen. And then the second half of the book really lays out a guide. It is a tool for creating a communication that would be complete, that would tap into all essences of the human being, And by creating such a guide, you will have the experience of communicating in a way that inspires. You'll never use the whole guide, but you'll always use part of the guide. And the actual process of developing it is really beneficial to anyone who wants to lead.
Terry, I know our time is just about up for our chat this morning. I really would appreciate having your website so people can find out more about you and your writing and your trainings that you have.
Sure, they can get to it just with terrypearce.com, and it's terrypearce.com, or leadingoutloud.com. We'll get them right to the same site. So that would be great. They could go in and read more about what our work is, and there's a blog attached that I contribute to from time to time, and I'd really enjoy feedback.
Terry Pearce has been my guest today. His website is terrypearce.com, P-E-A-R-C-E, and also leadingoutloud.com. I think it's important that we recognize as individuals we are very, very significant in life. And I'm not saying this just to put you on a pedestal. You can do that all by yourself. It's important for you to realize that part of leadership is being able to live life with passion, with purpose, and with an understanding that there's never an end of learning and growing and being. And you are important. You never know when you're going to touch the life of someone else and turn their life around because of the essence that you have within you. Leading Out Loud is the name of the book. Consider adding it to your library. I really think it is going to make you think and make you evaluate in a whole different method. Terry Pearce, thank you for being my guest today. It's been a delight having you. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We'll be back in just a moment.
Amino Muscle Snack Time, the chewable nutrition that feeds your muscles. Amino acids are the building blocks of protein. When you exercise, muscle tissue naturally breaks down. This low-cal, chewable snack helps to reverse that process and won't pack on the pounds. You can chew a few tasty vanilla tablets or any one of their other flavors before or after physical exercise, right before bedtime or first thing in the morning to jumpstart your metabolism into gear for the day. Convenient to carry in a purse, backpack, or briefcase, they are a tasty snack for the person on the go. Firm, fit muscles, trim, healthy body. Sound good to you? Check out Amino Muscle Snack Time Chewable Nutrition by going to Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Tone up, trim up, and nourish your body to the fitness level you desire. Amino Muscle Snack Time Nutritional Tablets. Check out the information and order today. Go to Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Order now.
We see it every day. Courts overflowing with frivolous lawsuits. People losing all of their assets simply because they were unprepared. The best defense against unscrupulous predators and creditors is a good offense. At Corporate Direct, we use the latest legal tools to help our clients of all sizes and from all over the world create a strategy to protect what is theirs. Think asset protection is only for the wealthy? Think again. Our Cover Your Assets strategies and tools are very affordable and practical. Industry leader Corporate Direct is owned and operated by attorney and best-selling author Garrett Sutton. Give us a call at 1-800-600-1760 or go to CorporateDirect.com to see how we can tailor a CYA plan for you. That's CYA, Cover Your Assets, with Corporate Direct. 1-800-600-1760. That's 1-800-600-1760 for CorporateDirect.com.
Do you have a product or service that you would like people to know about? Internet radio is a powerful medium that can assist you in reaching people who like to shop online and pass by electronic word of mouth information about you, your products, and or services. The Donna Sebo Show reaches around the world, and you can be part of that enterprising network. For more information, contact Vision Broadcasting via Donna at DelphiInternational.com.
Or call 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. Telephone lines are now open. Give me a call if you'd like to chat. I'd be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. Here is the toll-free number you can call into. It's 888-627-6000. 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about obesity undone. Now, you hear this rhetoric about excessive poundage with so many people today. And Joseph Leonardo is a guy that really can talk about this stuff. Why? Because he was over 400 pounds. I mean, the before and after pictures just make you go, is this really this person? Well, Joseph is going to tell us about what made him make the shift. This guy is a straight shooter. Also, on Friday, we're going to be talking about, as you know, I love animals. We're going to be talking about my animals myself. This is a publication by Marta Williams. And oh, she has so many wonderful stories to share. So we're going to be talking about some of those fur persons, as a very good friend of mine used to say, that makes such a difference in our life. So we've got a great lineup, and check show information so you get a brief write-up on the upcoming guest. And that's one of the things I really enjoy with doing the program, is being able to bring so many people from different positionings of experience, education, and letting them share their stories with you, because it really does make a difference. And without that communication, how are we going to know about options? You know, that's what communication is about, really. And sometimes, I don't know about you, but I can remember times in my life where my world of understanding was very narrow. It didn't involve very much of other cultures or other environments, because that's the little world I was in. And it's amazing, and I'll share with you, to me this is just a fun story. I had a very dear friend, Robert. He's since passed on. And Robert, when I knew him, was in his middle to late 60s. And he and his wife were often guests at our home, and I loved to cook, so I would just fix these wonderful meals, and we would talk about food. This was something that was just a topic of conversation, because he enjoyed good food as well, and his wife was a gourmet cook. And one evening he said to me, Donna, I've got to share something with you. He said, I've thoroughly enjoyed this meal, but I did not know how good food could taste. And I said, I don't understand what you're saying. He said, well, let me tell you. When I was growing up, he said, I thought my mother was the best cook in the world. That's the only thing I ever knew, was her cooking. And then I grew up and I went into the Navy. And then I realized my mother was a terrible cook. Wow, Navy food. Woohoo! It's good stuff. Great food. Loved it. And a plenty of it. Then he said he got married to his first wife, and she was a very good cook. And he goes, Navy food's good. Wow, this is better. Well, he and his first wife end up getting a divorce. When he married his wife, Barbara, she was a superb cook, a gourmet cook. And he really said, that's when I knew that things could even be better. Now, the reason I share this with you, and of course, it's an example of food, and what Robert was conveying to me, is that when he was growing up, the reason he thought his mother's was the best food, this was basically all he was getting. He came from a very poor family. The environment he was in was very restrictive. When he went into the Navy and was seeing the world, so to speak, then he was seeing a whole different environment. He was seeing a perspective of abundance. Well, he didn't have that earlier. The food was good food. When he married his first wife, who was a very good cook, it went up a grade. And then when he married Barbara, then it really went to what he considered the superb grade. And he could appreciate so many things. And I think that's the way life is. When we're open to expanding our world, when we're open to expanding our thinking, our minds, that is when we are going to find ourselves being able to make life a much richer experience. Now, I will have to say this. Sometimes when we are expanding our thinking and our experiences, we may get stomped on. And we go, oh, my goodness. Oh, that was a horrible thing. I don't know that I want to do that anymore. Oh, I'll never do that again. I have a friend that has that kind of attitude about traveling. Don't want to do it. Don't want to do this. Don't want to do that. Had a bad experience. That's it. Tried it. Didn't like it. That's it. And I find it sad because I have known this person for so many years, and their world is encapsulated, and they're very frightened. But in their mind, when one approach, one shift didn't work, that cut everything off. So you don't want to do that. If you try something and you don't like it, be open to trying something else. And remember, you may find that something didn't work out. Absolutely. You don't want to repeat that negative experience. That's true. But don't cut yourself off from something else. Learning to think, as we discussed in the interview today, is a process that's acquired. I can recall so many different times when, especially when I became involved in the metaphysical environment. And it was a process of thinking that was totally foreign to me. Yet, at the same time, it fit. It was natural. I loved it. I really liked it because it was creating something that I internally, deep within my very essence, I knew was real. But at the same time, I encountered individuals that would say, you do this in this purple box. You can't go over to blue or green box. Purple is only the way. And I'd stand there and I'd go, why is it that doesn't work? I'll give you an example. I had been instructed when I started developing my mind skills. I had been instructed that you could only do it when people were present in front of you. Well, that changed real fast. When I was visiting someone's home, they got a call from New York City. I was living in California at the time. They got a call from New York City, said, Donna, could you answer a question? I said, sure, go ahead and ask me. I didn't think. I just responded. They asked me the question. I gave the information. They relayed this information. The person was not present. They were thousands of miles away from me. Now, what happened was within a month, I got a response back from an individual saying, the same individual that asked me the question, my friend called me from New York, wanted you to know that the information, the insights you gave were right on the money. How did I do that? I honestly don't know. Now, today, I would say to you, because I have learned the language of communication, I would say there was a telepathic communication. Do I know the mechanics of how my mind could link with someone else's mind that I absolutely have never met, know nothing about, and yet I'm given specific information? How did I do it? Don't ask me. I can no more tell you the exact mechanics of it than a man in the moon. Other than saying that there is a communication capacity that we put a word on called telepathy that enables us to send and receive information. And I was able to get pictures in my mind. I was able to get specifics. I gave those specifics to that individual. It still amazes me to this day. I am as fascinated with it as people are that hear me or engage with me for private counseling or anything else. I find it absolutely amazing. There is this consciousness that has everything that has ever been thought, potentiality of thought. There's just this massive, I can't wrap my mind around it. But the gift it has given me is the understanding you don't have to. It works. It's there. It's for us to utilize. But we must learn how to think. This is Donna Sebo. When we come back, I'm going to share with you this story, yes, about a phenomenal woman named Jackie Mitchell. I started it yesterday and I ran out of time, so I'll be bringing that back. Or if you want to give me a call, 888-627-6008. We're taking a break. We're going to be right back.
Good health is something all of us want to have. Being aware of what we eat, its nutritional value, and how to balance our physical needs with our busy schedules is always a challenge. Amino Muscle Snack Time goes a long way towards helping us meet this challenge. Amino Muscle Snack Time is a nutritional food product that is portable, tasty, and in chewable tablet form, vanilla and honey flavors, a bonus for maintaining a healthy amino acid balance for healthy muscles. Amino Muscle Snack Time can be used anytime, anywhere, first thing in the morning to kickstart your metabolism. Take 20 minutes before or after a workout to help recover and build muscle. Take mid-morning or mid-afternoon to help curb cravings for unhealthy snacks. Weight loss, appetite control. Only top of the line and no genetically modified ingredients are used, no caffeine added. These chewable tablets can be ordered through Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Take charge and jumpstart your food program by adding Amino Muscle Snack Time by visiting Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com for more information. Order now.
Too many people become victims of frivolous lawsuits and scammers simply because they were unprepared. At Corporate Direct, we use the latest legal tools to help our clients of all sizes create a strategy to protect what is theirs. Asset protection is not only for the wealthy. Our strategies and tools are very affordable and practical. Give us a call at 1-800-600-1760 or go to CorporateDirect.com to see how we can help you. That's 1-800-600-1760 for CorporateDirect.com.
If you are an author and would like to be a guest on the Donna Sebo Show, please send a review copy of your publication along with a press release to the Donna Sebo Show, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington 98497. Allow 6 to 8 weeks for your material to be reviewed. Again, the address to send your material to is the Donna Sebo Show, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington 98497.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. As promised, I'm going to share with you the story of Jackie Mitchell. Now, this is a time of year when baseball is just so popular. Kids are out in baseball fields. I know in our own neighborhood, we have a school that has a baseball field, and it's so much fun to watch the kids, little leaguers and families out. It's just a wonderful American pastime and tradition, and it's a great way for kids to expend energy during the summer months, because here in the Pacific Northwest it rains so much of the other time of the year. So this is the time when you can get out and you can play on the field and really have a good time. Well, baseball in and of itself really became very, very popular, but girls playing baseball, you have got to be kidding. Well, today that's not a big issue, but back in the 1930s, it really was. And the woman I'm going to share this story about is Jackie Mitchell, 17 years old, and she is actually recognized in the National Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum in Cooperstown, New York. It all came about in the 1930s. Now, there is a small exhibit there on women in baseball. It's called Diamond Dreams. And she was the first. She really, really was. But not really the very first woman baseball player. Actually, there were women baseball teams, and I didn't know this, in the 1860s. Who knew? I didn't. I mean, I'm not a big sports person, so I didn't know. But most of the players in the 1860s were actresses, and they were really exploited by the male owners. In fact, the statement was the baseball games were like showtime, and it was a burlesque of the game, so it wasn't really serious playing. Well, around the turn of the century, then women that really loved the game, women athletes in general, were wanting to compete with the men, and sometimes they were playing on the same teams, and these were called semi-pro leagues. Now, the first woman that appeared in baseball's minor leagues, her name was Lizzie Arlington. And, of course, you know what the women of that day had to wear, the long dresses, oh, yes, all that stuff, and, of course, it's the turn of the century. Well, she wore bloomers, and that is scandalous. Oh, bloomers, my goodness, those woman were covered practically from head to toe. Look at where we are now. Well, that was then, so we just deal with history as it is. So being that Jackie isn't the first woman to play organized baseball, why is she so significant? Well, it's because of her being a superb picture, and she played a game in 1931 that stunned everyone. Now, she was being tutored by a neighbor. He was a minor league pitcher. His name was Charles Arthur Dazy, D-A-Z-Z-Y, Vance. Now, eventually, he went on to lead the National League in strikeouts for seven straight seasons. Now, when Mitchell's family moved to Chattanooga, Tennessee, she was an athlete. She played in a lot of different sports, and she joined a baseball school. Yeah, they actually had a baseball school. And it was affiliated with the city's Class AA minor league team. They were called the Lookouts, and she had a mean curveball. Little gal, she pitched that ball. People had to pay attention. Well, the man that was in charge of the Lookouts, his name was Joe Engel, and he really looked at her, saw what she was doing, and said, I've got someone here. She's a winner. And she was the first woman to be given a professional baseball contract. 17 years old, that is quite an accomplishment. Well, she was going to be facing the Yankees. That's right. Now, all kinds of comments were being made. Today's world wouldn't put up with it. But you have to remember, this is 1931. This is the kinds of things that they would say about her. She has a swell change of pace, swings a mean lipstick, and she didn't care. She powdered her nose. She was a girl. That was the thing she emphasized. 4,000 fans were attending the game, and she had Murderer's Row in front of her. That's right. What does that mean? Fearsome lineup. So, by golly, she pitched. Babe Ruth was at bat. She struck him out. Lou Gehrig. She struck him out. It blew people away. Now, the statement was, women will never make good in baseball because they're too delicate. It would kill them to play ball every day. Oh, my goodness. This young woman proved to them women could do that and even more. A fun story, and I think that Joe DiMaggio's statement is the ladies should be permitted to play. Actually, Marilyn Monroe said that. She was married to Joe DiMaggio at the time. I correct myself here. She said, ladies should be permitted to play. I can't think of a better way to meet outfielders. Leave it to Marilyn to make a statement like that. But I'll tell you what, the gals could make the game a fascinating one, and it was a 17-year-old with a mean curveball that struck out two of the greats. It's history. Check it out. This is Donna Sebo. My goodness, time has just gone by so fast. I'm so delighted that you have been able to be with me today. Won't you join me tomorrow? I'd love to have you as a guest. I think you'll find what we share on the Donna Sebo Show insightful. And maybe it'll give you some ideas of your own. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You're the captain of your soul. You're the boss of your space. Nobody else. Enjoy life. Expand. Live with an awareness that you're a very special gift to this experience of life. Ask those questions. Who are you? Why am I here? Take time to sit under the stars, reflect. Maybe sit in a coffee shop and reflect. But give yourself that time. God bless. I'll see you tomorrow. Join me, won't you? I'd love to have you. Take care. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.